Oh yay, oh yay, oh yay. All persons having business before the Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and His Honorable Court. Be seated, please. Case number 08-5370 et al. William G. Moore, Jr., Appellant, Blanche K. Moore versus Michael Hartman et al. Mr. Pohl for the appellant, Mr. Montague for the appellees.
Morning, counsel. Yes, we wish you would.
May it please the court. I'm Paul Michael Pohl for appellant William G. Moore, Jr. This is the fourth time it's been my pleasure to appear before this court on this case, which is now in its 19th year. We submit on this appeal that the district court erred in granting defendant appellee's motion for summary judgment. As my argument will address, the district court applied the wrong legal standard, and it didn't properly review the record as it was obligated to do on a summary judgment motion, viewing the evidence in the record in light most favorable to the non-moving party and drawing all reasonable inferences in favor of the non-moving party. And we submit that even if the court could have applied the legal standard that it did properly, that if it had done the correct analysis of the facts as Rule 56 required, summary judgment still should have been denied. The record here, developed in years of discovery, is extraordinary. There is remarkable evidence of retaliatory intent, abuse of the grand jury, witness coercion, and an indictment without probable cause.
That is really what the case is about, is that last phrase, isn't it? Whether we can look behind the finding of probable cause by the grand jury, or to what extent we can look behind the finding of probable cause by the grand jury.
That's correct.
Ordinarily, the grand jury is the body charged in our judicial system with the determination of probable cause. What kind of opinion can we write with a precedential view? You know, we can't write just for your case. And what is our opinion going to say about how much you can look behind a grand jury indictment?
Your Honor, you have hit the issue, you've articulated perfectly. I suggest that the correct articulation of what the legal standard is and should be is reflected in the opinions of at least five circuits. That would be White versus Frank, the Second Circuit, Hand versus Gray, the Fifth Circuit, Hinchman versus Moore, the Sixth Circuit, Jones versus City of Chicago, the Seventh Circuit, Harris versus Roderick, the Ninth Circuit, and it is stated very well in the pronouncement of this court in Whalen versus Abel. Now there, in fairness, it's not a clear holding, but it is certainly a pronouncement with approval, citing Westreich versus McFarland, the Fourth Circuit. And the proper statement of the law, I submit, should be, as this court said in Whalen versus Abel, while a majority, and this squares with the majority of the states, while a majority of the states holds that an indictment is prima facie or presumptive evidence that probable cause existed for the prosecution, the plaintiff in a malicious prosecution action has the right to bring forth evidence that the defendant obtained the indictment by fraudulently misrepresenting or withholding material facts. That's it.
Yeah, that's what concerns me here. I don't think you can make out fraudulent misrepresentation, can you? Let's just take that one.
Oh, I think I can, Your Honor.
All right, what is your best shot at fraudulent misrepresentation?
Your Honor, if the standard is, as I suggest it should be, fraudulently misrepresenting, withholding material facts, or as it says in White versus Frank, falsifying evidence?
Yeah, all right, let's take any of those three. We'll start with the fraudulent misrepresentation like I was trying to, and you tell me what your best shot is.
All right, Your Honor, on the record fairly reviewed here, we know that the defendants created a document at the end of the grand jury investigation that concluded, in their words, and this is Appendix 2758, that Mr. Moore individually was not aware of Voss's actions. So the people that looked at the whole...
2758.
2758. That's the appendix. It's called Strategic Reasons for Indicting the Corporation.
Now, where on that document are you finding those words that you're reading?
It's if in 2758, it says Strategic Reasons for Indicting. Mm-hmm. Subparagraph A is redacted. In B, it says Marcus Naw et al. Those are the bad guys.
You read that whole paragraph, it doesn't say at all what you just told me.
It says, in some instances, can conclusively testify that REI, Moore, Reedy, and or Bray, mm-hmm. but not Moore or Reedy individually.
You're reading the little pieces of that the paragraph. The paragraph says, Marcus Naw et al., in some instances, can conclusively testify that, I guess it's supposed to be, is it REI, that's the
yes.
corporation, Moore, Reedy, and or Bray, but not more or Reedy individually were aware of Voss's corrupt actions and the exchange of confidential UPS information. So it does not say at all that Moore was not aware. It says that those witnesses, those two particular witnesses, can testify as to other people being aware, but they can't testify as to Moore. That's consistent with the possibility that Moore is not aware. It's also consistent with the possibility that Moore is aware, but these witnesses don't know it. It's really agnostic on the question of whether, in fact, Moore was aware.
Your Honor, it says, but not Moore individually. And it's
difficult. It says that in a sentence that begins, X and Y can testify to these other facts, but not to that fact. It doesn't say Moore was not aware. It says those witnesses cannot testify.
Right. And, Your Honor, throughout the year and a half of the investigation of the grand jury, they interviewed people 20, 40, 80 times, including in jail. And nobody's... I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Where are you finding fraudulent misrepresentation? What is the misrepresentation that we should say is fraudulent sufficient to overcome the presumption of regularity of a grand jury indictment?
Your Honor, I focus on three things. First, the Spartan evidence. Mr. Spartan was interviewed at least in 23 separate sessions over a year and a half. He was repeatedly invited to say more no. And this was after the other co-conspirators would never say Moore knew, because he didn't know. So Spartan is their last hope of tying Moore into the conspiracy.
What was the misrepresentation that was presented? I'm not asking you about the whole history.
Your Honor, it is our position that when you read the misrepresentation or the falsification of evidence, when you have a witness who has told you...
When you're going against a presumption as strong as a grand jury indictment, and you're saying there was a fraudulent misrepresentation, it ought to be easy to answer my question. What was that fraudulent misrepresentation?
When you
give me the quotation of the misrepresentation.
When, Your Honor, I can't give you a quotation that is a flat, bald-faced lie.
Okay.
But on terms of falsification of evidence, I can show that what they did would be enough to support a conviction for witness tampering or obstruction of justice under 18 U.S.C. 1512. They had multiple witnesses who said repeatedly Moore didn't know. So what they did with their last witness, Spartan, they wrongly disclosed 60 evidence to him. Then they gave him they planned to try to coerce and intimidate him. They had 6 to 10 agents surround him, shout at him, tear up his immunity letter and threaten his son with prosecution. Then, in a polygraph exam, shortly thereafter, he said 19 more times Moore didn't know, versions of that. And then he said, but I've seen the stuff they showed me and it seems like you have enough. If you just tell my lawyer what you want me to say. Then they massaged the witness.
All of these are bad things. I understand that, and I understand that the lines were crossed in the investigation. But I'm asking you some pretty direct questions as to what was the falsified evidence and what was the misrepresentation. Don't tell me the history of how they got there.
Your Honor,
tell me what
the falsification of evidence is when you have a witness who says, Moore didn't know, we didn't tell him. If you coerce him to then say a bogus opinion that he had to have known, and you look at what it takes, as to Spartan, Your Honor, that is what happened, and that is improper. Now, the cases don't just talk about...
Improper is not going to get you there, though. This is a grand jury indictment and a strong presumption.
Your Honor, the legal standard says it is just evidence. That's what the restatement 644 and 643H say. And the district court missed the comment in 643H. It is just evidence that can be rebutted by the wrongful withholding or suppressing of evidence. And that was done here with Bray's statement, which is also cited in our brief. The witness had to negotiate with the agents what he would be allowed to say to the grand jury. Judge Hovell, now Judge Hovell, was his lawyer. The U.S. attorney went home, and they said they wouldn't put in his statement. They were only allowed to read their statements to the grand jury. He wouldn't put in that, but Moore didn't know. They put all this circumstantial stuff up they thought would influence the grand jury. They wouldn't allow him to say Moore didn't know. The deal that was cut with the agents was, at the end of reading his summary, he would be allowed to say anything you want to add. But Mr. Valder wrote in the margin, don't reveal, and he wasn't allowed to do that in the grand jury. So if you have a witness that you affirmatively act to keep from telling the grand jury the whole truth, that's the sort of falsification of evidence or improper conduct that's under the great majority.
The problem I'm trying to get to is those are not synonymous. Falsification of evidence and improper conduct are not synonymous.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And I don't think we can write an opinion that says improper conduct will get you past the presumption.
No, Your Honor, I think the opinion is what White versus Frank and what this court said in its earlier pronouncement that I quoted is the right law. And the reason where the district judge got it wrong was he made the exception so narrow and insurmountable. It's inconceivable that the U.S. Supreme Court would have taken cert in this case if they thought the only way you could establish probable cause was by this narrow, narrow exception of fraud on the grand jury. I think the right statement, and where the district court got off the track again, was when he wouldn't say you could rebut the presumption by showing that they suppressed exculpatory evidence. It was error for the district court to look to U.S. versus Williams. There's a lot of good policy reasons why, on a motion to dismiss an indictment, you can't talk about exculpatory evidence. But grand juries and motions to dismiss indictments have lived for centuries next to the law on malicious prosecution. And on a malicious prosecution case,
it has never been the norm that prosecutors going to grand juries took all the possible exculpatory evidence.
And I'm not arguing that, Your Honor. But I'm arguing once you're in a malicious prosecution setting, and we knew it was our burden to show absence of probable cause, at that point you can show wrongful suppression of exculpatory evidence. So here you have, I think they suborned perjury, but they sugarcoated it by calling it an opinion with Spartan. And the coercion and intimidation should not occur in the United States. And then not letting witnesses...
There again, counsel, that's not the test. Coercion should not occur in the United States.
Well, Your Honor, I think under White versus Frank and those other six circuits, if you bring forward evidence to rebut the presumption that they falsified or wrongfully suppressed or coerced or intimidated witnesses, that evidence goes to the jury.
Do you think either one of those is sufficient? And do you need to have all of them, or is suppression of
evidence? It's worded in the disjunctive, Your Honor, in the other circuits' cases. Anything under those headings. But of course, if you just allege it, it isn't going to get you to the jury. But what the district
court... It's going to survive summary judgment.
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I didn't hear
you. Just allege it, it's not going to survive summary judgment.
That's right. But here we have disputed issues of fact, and the court didn't do the review of those in the light most favorable to us. It's interesting here that we're on a developed record. We know that the district court said we didn't give them Hartman's deposition transcript. We did. It's in the appendix. It is at page 2157. It's unfortunate we didn't have argument in the district court, but Hartman wouldn't use the word coercion, but he said we tried to influence Spartan. The evidence read in light most favorable to us show they planned to surround that guy and shout at him and tear up his letter. Why would they do that? The district court said it didn't create an inference they were trying to change his testimony. They've interviewed him 23 times. Why would you plan that charade unless you were trying to coerce the guy? Now, he couldn't say what he had already told them the opposite of, so they sweetened it up as an opinion, and it was a bogus, coerced opinion. And that, coupled with the intentional suppression of exculpatory evidence, is enough to get us to a jury in this case. In terms of the policy for future cases, I think you just follow all the other circuits. This case exists as an outlier now because it says it's a nearly conclusive presumption.
You said that the district court applied the wrong standard, but
correct.
You also said there were material, genuine issues of fact.
Yes.
If we agreed with you that the standard that should be applied is the standard in White, say the Second Circuit standard, would we need to go further and look at this question of issues of fact?
Your Honor, it doesn't take very long given the evidence of clear retaliatory intent or that they formed a conclusion that Moore didn't know individually and the other coercion to say we're required to do a review of all the evidence in the record, draw the inferences in the light most favorable to Mr. Moore. And it's a jury question then. And the cases are clear here that that probable cause is ordinarily a jury question. And we clearly have disputed issues of fact. It's just what inferences you can draw from them. I'm eating into my rebuttal time.
Well, we've actually used your rebuttal time, but we'll give you some back.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
We're not nearly as wedded to our lights as some courts are. And that's not being critical of the Supreme Court, just different. Counsel? But we're careful not to be critical of the Supreme Court, you understand. Morning, Counsel.
Morning, Your Honor. Morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. I'm Richard Montague here today on behalf of the United States and the five postal inspectors who are sued on the Bivens retaliatory prosecution claim. In granting summary judgment, the district court followed the familiar rule that an indictment is prima facie evidence of probable cause that may be overcome only by showing misconduct that substantially affected the grand jury.
Did the district court actually follow that rule? The first question I have, and maybe you can help me sort this out, is I thought the district court said, in fact, the indictment was conclusive on that point, and then later modified it with a very stringent standard. Your brief started off saying it's a rebuttable presumption, but then seemed to apply the exception narrowly as the district court had done. And so that was confusing to me. Could you articulate exactly what the government's position is here?
Our position is where there is an indictment, that is prima facie evidence of probable cause.
So you're not arguing that it's conclusive?
Not in the sense that it cannot be challenged ever. No, Your Honor, that's correct.
But are you in fact saying that the district court applied the right standard? In other words, this very narrow exception?
Yes, that's correct. That's correct. There is an indictment, the presumption of probable cause, the prima facie proof of probable cause is in place, and then it is the burden on the plaintiff to overcome that by showing that the indictment was procured through misconduct.
Well, again, I'm not quite sure. Are you agreeing with Mr. Pohl that a standard like White, like the Second Circuit, would be sufficient, or are you actually arguing that what the district court did here is the proper standard?
What the district court did here was the proper standard. I think it depends on what kind of misconduct showing one thinks is sufficient to overcome the indictment presumption. In our view, showing knowing use of perjured testimony, that would overcome the indictment presumption. As far as this issue of withholding evidence, this court need not, to rule in our favor, you need not go so far as to say there is never a situation in which the government withholds evidence.
You couldn't defend that proposition, could you?
No, Your Honor, because you can have situations in which evidence is withheld, and it's just crystal clear there is no probable cause. For example, suppose a rape victim identifies an accuser, but the police know they have that person in custody at the time of the crime. To submit the identification to the grand jury.
There are lots of hypotheticals that can establish the point, but question here where you've got an intense investigation that has never produced any witness who will say as a factual matter that Moore knew anything about the conspiracy, and the grand jury is steered away from those facts. So which side of the line does that fall on, counsel?
That falls on the side of the line that of conduct that does not overcome the indictment presumption, because the evidence we are talking about here is exculpatory, really in more the Brady versus Maryland sense, evidence that would be helpful to the accused in mounting a defense. And indeed, in this case, the government submitted evidence to the grand jury that really should have left no doubt. There were no express discussions between the plaintiff and officials of his company on the one hand and the consultants on the other of kickbacks. For example, the government was relying on evidence of exchanges such as Mr. Reedy, Mr. Moore's co-defendant, asking, what is your arrangement with Voss, the postal governor who accepted the kickbacks? And the consultant saying, it's better you not know. When the government is relying on evidence like that to establish the link, it's clear there are no express discussions of any kickbacks.
But this is a different standard and more stringent, I think, than any other circuit court has imposed on a retaliatory or malicious prosecution case. And I'm wondering, are you aware of any other circuit that has imposed such a stringent standard?
Well, the district court relied on White versus Frank from the Second Circuit.
I don't think so.
But
hey, you're using the same words as White versus Frank.
But in our view, withholding of evidence not withholding of like Brady type exculpatory evidence is what will overcome the presumption. And indeed, the Second Circuit, in its case,
I think you have, that there is a point at which that does become the withholding that warrants a look behind the indictment. Your rape case hypothetical was a case, but that's, I don't see where you're drawing a line that says there's some evidence that's Brady, but it's not withholding. There's some evidence that's exculpatory, but it is withholding.
And line drawing is difficult to do. You know, we readily acknowledge, Your Honor, but it seems there has to be some space left for the situation in which, withholding.
Grand juries have to get through with their work, and investigators have other cases to work, and so it can't be that you have to take all the possible exculpatory evidence to the grand jury.
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. And certainly not the evidence that's alleged here, Your Honor.
But I'm not sure why this isn't some of that evidence. If it's in fact the case that this witness was interviewed 19 times or whatever it was, and all of those times he said there was no connection between Moore and the knowledge of the kickbacks, and then they did have a session where you had 10 people screaming at him and tearing up his immunity or his plea agreement, and then he said, well, if I look at all that evidence, maybe he did have to know. If that is the case and the grand jury doesn't know it, are we sure that doesn't fall on the side of the line with the rape case rather than on the normal side of the line?
No, Your Honor, it's not on that side of the line. For one thing, the witness Spartan, he did not say, Moore has no connection. What he said was, I did not tell Moore, and I wasn't there. If anyone else told Moore, I don't know about it.
Why did the prosecutors need the statement that counsel referred to about, based on what I've seen, then he must have known? Why did they need that statement?
It's not our view that the prosecutors needed that.
They tried awfully hard to get it, didn't they?
That's the allegation.
The allegations are backed up by affidavits at this point, right?
Well, pardon me.
The allegations are backed up by affidavit at this point.
No. There's.
Is it not off record that there was this session with the 10 agents and the tearing up of the? Or am I blurring two things?
No, there is evidence that yes.
There is evidence that this is summary judgment stage. I'm not asking you to concede that it happened, but at least on this record, it looks like they tried awfully hard to get that statement from Spartan and then used it. Now, unless they needed it, why did they go to that kind of length to get it if they had a case without that?
What the record shows is that Mr. Spartan was not forthcoming on a number of matters, and he and his attorney were summoned to a meeting at the U.S. Attorney's Office where he was confronted about those matters. But it was at a conference. All the evidence shows it was at a conference room in the United States Attorney's Office. And if the man was surrounded, he was surrounded in the same sense I'm surrounded here this morning, Your Honor.
I don't know. I've spent several years with the U.S. Attorney's Office, and I don't ever remember a session like that with a witness. Never mind. Go ahead.
In any event, Your Honor, the district court's decision was correct because there is just no link here between the opinion, as the district court said, and the government conduct that the plaintiff alleges. The only evidence in this record of any discussion between the witness, Mr. Spartan, and anyone from the government over what he might say is in the polygraph, when he shows up at his polygraph examination in December 2006. Now, that's after the alleged tactics designed to get him to incriminate the plaintiff. And he says, look, you know, I don't know what it is you guys want me to say. In addition, during the course of that polygraph, he continues to repeat the statements that, you know, supposedly drew the government's ire, namely, I didn't tell more about the kickback scheme, and I wasn't there when anyone told more about the kickback scheme. And he says, I don't know what it is you guys want me to say. And in response, Inspector Robbins says to him, we, quote, want to find out what you did and what you were told and you told others. That's all. You know, just a simple matter of truth. It's page 3176 of the appendix. And twice more, Inspector Robbins was quite explicit, you know, don't lie. Just tell us what happened. And he was even explicit, the government does not want to bring a case based on any false accusation. So that is the only place anywhere in this record of any evidence of any exchange between Spartan on the one hand and someone from the government on the other as to you know, the substance of Spartan's testimony. And the exchange is, we just want to know what happened and tell the truth. In addition, there's not even any evidence here that the opinion actually is false. Indeed, at the very in this court's first opinion in this case, in note 4 of the opinion, the court said, you know, we read Moore's complaint not to allege that the government manufactured false evidence to incriminate Moore. And that is still the operative complaint here at this stage of the proceeding. And finally, I don't think one rationally can't say that the grand jury indicted based on the Spartan opinion rather than on the basis of the evidence that already was before the grand jury. So in a sense, the claim rather lifts itself by its bootstraps. Under ordinary summary judgment principles, the plaintiff must come forward with evidence to make the link. And as I say here, the critical—
The link being a causation link? Is that what you're—
The link that the government conduct caused the opinion and that the opinion was the basis for the grand jury indictment.
I don't see how that could ever be met.
It can't be met on this record, no.
I don't see how that could ever be met. The grand jury cannot be questioned about why it voted the way it did. And without that, how would you ever be able to prove? I guess maybe if you had some very discreet case with a very discreet piece of evidence, but is that really the way the link has to be? If you can show that false testimony. Suppose they could, in fact, show that there was subornation of perjury for the grand jury. Would they have to separately show the causation link between that subornation and the indictment?
They wouldn't have to in terms of asking the individual grand jurors.
What would be enough, in your view, to meet that? Let's go to one of your hypotheticals here and tell me what would be enough.
To show that
causation link you're talking
about. Well, I think the situation, Your Honor, is probably analogous to when a plaintiff challenges a search warrant on the basis of misrepresentation to the magistrate judge. If you excise out the tainted information and then the remainder doesn't establish probable cause, that—
Without— You get on a circle on that because we're trying to determine if there was probable cause. Grand jury presumption is your best arrow in that quiver. Without that piece of evidence, do we have to reweigh probable cause to determine whether there's probable cause? I mean, you're getting the benefit of a presumption, and then you're wanting to say you can't get around that presumption without getting around the presumption. I'm sort of lost on your reasoning on this one.
To overcome the indictment presumption, the presumption of probable cause,
yeah.
the, plaintiff must show, of course, misconduct that would substantially affect the grand jury's
decision. Now, suppose
decision.
We said that expression of testimony by Spartan was enough to have done that. Do we then have to excise it and weigh the rest of the evidence that went before the grand jury and determine again a brand new the probable cause determination?
That seems
before we can get around the presumption.
No, once misconduct is shown, I have.
So the link is not necessary in order to go behind the presumption. I thought you were saying they had to show that link to get behind the presumption, but maybe I misunderstood you.
They do have to show the link to get behind the presumption because they have to establish some misconduct that would have affected the grand jury's indictment decision. And if the claim is the grand jury would not have indicted without this testimony to overcome the presumption, then you have to show that this testimony, is.
Can I ask you about your reading of something in the Supreme Court opinion? The Supreme Court fashioned this rule for retaliatory prosecution when it's directed at the one defendant you can get to, that is the police officers rather than the prosecutor, and said, we've got to carve out something different because you've got the animus of one person influencing the decision of another person. Now, in the last page of the opinion, the court says, and I'd like to get what you think they mean by this. In this case, for example, Moore cannot succeed in the retaliation claim without showing that the assistant U.S. attorney was worse than just an unabashed careerist. Now, that's too negative, so that means to me that he could succeed if he showed that Valder was worse than an unabashed careerist. Now, does that mean that since you can't get Valder, does that mean that the law enforcement officers have to he has to be in cahoots with them. In other words, he's got to be worse than just an unabashed careerist. What does that mean? That they can influence him, that is the law enforcement officers, but he's got to have a bad motive too? I don't understand what the court meant by that would be enough if Moore could show that Valder was worse than an unabashed careerist.
Your Honor, I'm not sure I read the passage with much more clarity than you do.
They throw the prosecutor back into this at the very end.
My reading of that is what they mean to say is that he's worse than an unabashed careerist in that he's a prosecutor who has proceeded in a case where there is no probable cause to proceed.
Okay.
They do put it into conjunctive, though. Worse than an unabashed careerist, and if he can show that the prosecutor had no probable cause. So that it sounds as if, as Judge Henderson suggests, they meant something different by that first phrase.
Yes, but the holding of the case, though, is that to establish the claim against the postal inspectors, the plaintiff must show the absence of probable cause for the resulting prosecution.
I guess we're through with questions. Thank you. We'll hear from the appellant in rebuttal. He's out of time, I think, but we'll give you back 3 minutes for rebuttal, counsel.
Thank you very much. I usually just
give two, so I've been very
generous. Your Honor, I'm very grateful after 19 years. Your Honor, a point that should not be lost is during the Supreme Court argument, Justice Bader Ginsburg asked counsel for the government if they were arguing for the conclusive presumption. They expressly disclaimed that.
They've disclaimed that.
And of course, now we have...
Nobody now says the presumption concludes.
No, it's unfortunate the word's in there, though, because it muddles the analytical reasoning. This is really about how big the exception is. And I think the majority is as stated in White versus Frank. It says, the presumption may be rebutted by proof that the defendant misrepresented, withheld, or falsified evidence. And the evidence here reviewed on the Rule 56 standard creates a fact question for that. And under Davis versus Giles, this circuit has said probable cause is a question for the jury when the facts are disputed. So we submit, if you take the right standard and you look at the existing law, that everything has to be looked at and probable cause goes to the jury. Second point, Your Honor, is on the Spartan situation. We're not proceeding just on affidavits, Your Honor. We have deposition testimony in the appendix for the facts I've described. The postal inspectors started pointing at each other. One said it went from bad to worse. Two of them in deposition said Bray not being allowed to change his statement was against their procedures. If they had a witness that wanted to change it, they would have let the guy. So here they took the massaged, misleading, arguably falsified statements, and when they needed to have that last link from Spartan. Now, these were grand jury 6E statements. They broke the rules again, not just by massaging the statements, but by showing them to the last witness in the chain, because they had already said they didn't have evidence that Moore knew individually. They took the massaged evidence, wrongly disclosed it to a witness, worked on him some more, threatened his kid with prosecution, shouted at him, and then he gave the bogus opinion. And if you look at the opinion, they talk about, well, the guy invited him to talk about the facts. If you read the appendix sections, he talks about Reedy, he talks about other people. He doesn't talk about Mr. Moore. That was the causative link, the disclosure, the coercion, and the use of the misleading statements. And finally, Your Honor, there is a lot of law that says what U.S. versus Williams says. You can't complain about the failure to use exculpatory evidence. That law is all in the criminal side. That's all on a motion to dismiss an indictment. That does not apply.
I'm not sure why you think the presumption would be stronger, the ability to go behind the grand jury would be stronger on the civil side than on the criminal. It seemed to me that the distinction you're making cut against you.
Well,
that if there's any time when it's critical for the indictment to be valid, it's when you're taking somebody, depriving somebody of life, liberty, or property on the basis of it.
Well,
here, I don't see why you think your case is better for going behind the grand jury.
Well, Your Honor, presumptions are common in the law. On the civil side, we deal with them. And all this is, it is some evidence of probable cause. We can rebut it in three ways, as set out in White versus Frank. And I think this court should embrace that to get with the majority in the restatement. But once we brought in the facts we did from the depositions, that's a fact question. Your Honor, I thank this court. If you have any questions.
Yeah, I have a question. I want to ask you the same thing I asked the Justice Department. This is a matter of strategy, so you don't have to answer it. But I wonder why you have not made use of Balder's no longer a defendant, but he is a witness. And he did say, as I remember, I don't care what the evidence shows, this is going to make me a big-time prosecutor. Why you didn't use that in view of this language from the Supreme Court, that if Moore could show that the AUSA was worse than just an unabashed careerist, that would help.
We use that in our brief, Your Honor, but it's cited. There's an affidavit where Valder said to a grand jury witness who said, Bill Moore's such a good guy, he'd never be involved in anything like this. And Valder said, I don't care if whether he's guilty or not doesn't concern me. I want to get an indictment of a high-profile guy so I can get a lucrative job in private practice. That's what the affidavit says. Now, when I read that unabashed careerist thing, I'm not sure whether that exactly how to parse that sentence. But what we have here is the additional thing, a lot of times we say, well, the Justice Department's supervising, it's a filter against a bad indictment and malicious prosecution. So here, that filter doesn't apply if they wanted to argue that. But more importantly, Valder, by abdicating his responsibility to shape the testimony, like he went home and let the agents tell Bray what he was allowed to say, that means that there was more than just an unabashed careerist who wasn't the proper filter. He was abdicating things. Maybe we could have made more of it, but the briefing here is what it was. But it's powerful evidence that it didn't work here, and we have evidence that can rebut the normal presumptions. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. I don't normally do this, but I failed to ask the government attorney something I meant to ask you. I want to call him back to the podium in a minute. I had overlooked, and counsel reminded me of it in his rebuttal, the 6E violation. What do you say to that?
To the 6E violation?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. This is a 6E violation, isn't it, for the use of the other grand jury testimony to...
Well, on the legal two points, Your Honor. On the legal issues presented in this case, as Your Honor pointed out, you know, misconduct is not the same thing as absence of probable cause. In terms of the use of the summary materials here, if the court would like to know the department's position on that. Yeah. The Office of Professional Responsibility did look into the matter, concluded that use of materials, including grand jury testimony to refresh recollection is permissible, and essentially concluded that this was, you know, it did recognize that one document did, you know, bear an indication showing that it, I mean, this was material prepared outside the grand jury, but one document did show that it had been used in the grand jury, and you know, OPR considered that, you know, may well be a technical 6E violation, but it's consistent with department
policy. I called
policy.
You back up, and it's my fault, so you...
Can I ask one question?
Okay, while you're up,
Your Honor.
That's the danger. Once we get you up here, we may never let you go.
Well, this, I just, is Mr. Balder still with the Department of Justice?
Yes, he is, Your Honor.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Yes.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Case is submitted. Call the next case.